God, and looking at the characteristics of God throughout the Old Testament right now, where we are, I don't know if we'll forever really get, you know, to the New Testament or not, like we should be, but there's just so many rich things in here. It's hard not to get bogged down once in a while and just really kind of slow down, take your time on some of these incredible narratives about history and what's happened, and it shows us so much about God. But as we'd like to do, we'd like to try to learn something rather than just being encouraged and hearing the same old things. And so I'd like to go through this in review so that we can start to put into our minds and start to memorize a little bit some of the things that we've tried to learn so that we can have a better view. I've often thought that one of the things that we do, and maybe I've said this before, is we just don't put it in the overall picture so much. And it really is harder to remember things when you don't see it in a chronological sequence. When you don't see where it fits, it's harder to understand how that applies. And I think we do that, we do a kind of a disservice to our children a lot that way, because of our Bible classes are really not made so much in chronological order for them after they get out of that young stage. Then we start, you know, topical, and then we hit and miss, and then we get up to a point where we think they know a lot, and we start a lot of this application and kind of modern day thing, and they still wouldn't be able to even tell you the whole kind of sweeping scenes of the Bible and the narrative. And I think that's important. At least that's what I have found, and I found for myself it was a neglected part of my study. So I like this, just going through, being able to put it all in perspective and in the sequence of history. So going through our chapters review, we have divided the Bible up, and of course we're doing it about as difficult as I can now this way, just letting you try to think about the actual chapters and how we have labeled them and what that means to how you would sequence events in your mind. So that first section that we have is Genesis 1 and 2, the world prior to sin. And even though it's a very small section in the Bible, it does seem to be significant that the Bible is divided right after this section. We also said that Genesis 1 and 2 were special in certain ways, that we can kind of remember what happened in Genesis chapter 1 in a thematic way, and that was God and perfection. God and perfection. God telling us about himself through the creation, and he saw everything and that it was very good. And then, of course, chapter 2, man and innocence, that period of time with that relationship with God before the fall. And that's what we find in Genesis chapter 3 through 12. These are the patriarchs, the background of redemption. And specifically in chapter 3, we find the fall of man. The background of redemption we find here, obviously, the big stories of man continuing to fail in front of God and not obeying his word, not being able to keep their faith, and such monumental events as Genesis chapter 6, where he destroys the earth. And it grieves him at his heart. He repents God that he even made man. But even then, he keeps the hope alive through his mercy and grace, Noah finding favor or grace in his eyes. We find Genesis 12 through 50. This is the patriarchs here, the call of Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. Get thee from thy kindred, from thy father's house, into the land that I will show you. And I'll make of thee a great nation. And I will bless thee and make thy name great. Be thou a blessing, and him that blesseth thee I will bless, and him that curseth thee I will curse. And in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. And in Genesis chapter 22, he will repeat that promise. And in thy seed shall all the families of the earth be blessed. So through Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and Joseph. And that is 12 through 50. But with Joseph, and just an incredible human being in front of God. What a faithful, faithful servant of God. But we find ourselves after that great epic with slavery in and judgment upon Egypt. God later calls this the furnace, the fiery furnace that he has kept Israel in slavery. And we talked about some of the reasons there. Exodus chapter 1 through 12. Now, this one is a little bit more difficult to divide up here in your mind if you think about this next section, because it begins to be a little bit harder. But 13 through 18 is a two-month journey to Sinai. It covers that whole period. 13 through 18, a whole period journeying to Mount Sinai. I find that a little bit more difficult anyway. And then Exodus 19 through Numbers 10, 1 year at Sinai. Again, a little bit more difficult, but easier to start with in Exodus 19. They prepare to meet God on the mountain. And we know it flows right into Exodus 20, the Ten Commandments. And from there, he's going to flow on into all of the laws and the sundry laws that will take part. Now remember, it's not only just a religious law, but it's a civil law as well. And that gets a lot of people confused. You know, God changed his religious laws, but he laid down civil laws that would take care of their society. And I'm not so sure that we need to be able to be so quick to try to remove those things. And as we talked about some of the stories about capital punishment and those types of things, certainly not against the characteristic of God. The next section is a little bit more difficult, I think, after Numbers 10. They have prepared there. They started numbering. And then here, Numbers 11 through 14 is unbelief. Now, we can mark a lot of these chapters with Israel's history with unbelief, can't we? I mean, it's just one event after another, and we're going to see some of those again today. But in this period of time, there's a reason here, and that is because this is them going up to Kadesh Barnea, and this is them displaying the faith that they do not have, and then having that ultimate consequence of their actions, which is you are not going to enter in the promised land. I've given it to you, I've promised you, I've brought you out of Egypt with a strong hand, I've done all these things for you, and you get to this point, and you go on, and then your knees become as jelly as you look out at all these giants in the land of milk and honey. Hard to understand, really, but we see Caleb and Joshua here, the only two. Joshua's real name, of course, is, anybody remember that? Hoshea. So, and I think it's significant because Joshua related to Jesus in the you know, as the words transliterate later on and through history, but it's Moses that changes his name to Joshua. And then we see Joshua playing such a significant role, bringing the children into the promised land. 1 year at Sinai, and real quickly again, the law was given. We know that the pattern of the tabernacle was disclosed. It was constructed. Of course, the Levitical priesthood there, the sacrificial system was revealed, and the nation was numbered and organized at that point. So they're leaving the mountain. One thing that we haven't had time to do, and I haven't done a whole lot of this, so I wanted to bring in one of these things for you, and that is to take a look at this. I wanted to bring in a little bit more about archaeology as we're going along, but we seem to keep running out of time, and I run out of time preparing, but this is an interesting discovery that I want you to look at. Gabriel Barkay, here's a doctor, scientist. He's in the Middle East 1975 to 1980, and he's in the southern part of the old town of Jerusalem. He's digging around there in the sands of time. He's doing his thing, and in 1979, they come upon a tomb. The tomb predates the Babylonian captivity. So there's a lot of things that have happened since the time that somebody was buried in that tomb. So now it's going back prior to at least 606, it's prior to the Nebuchadnezzar and Babylonian captivity, certainly 586, but 606 is what they're thinking prior to that period of time. It could be 100 years prior. It's a little bit hard to tell at that point, but they know it was prior to the sacking of Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar. And what they find is two tiny scrolls. When I say two tiny scrolls, I mean they're about an inch high and about a half an inch wide. That's right. You'd have a hard time reading them, even if we made them just today, right? But after 1,500 years, you can imagine it's a little bit hard, a scroll of silver that's rolled up in that size, very small. So it takes them months to go through the chemical things that they need to do to try to determine that they could even unroll these scrolls. A lot of times they just destroy evidence out of hand because they try it. But they take these scrolls, they try to unroll them. Now realize what, if you pick up a modern book or if you even go to a school of theology in Europe or something like that, or one of the more liberal schools in America, what are they going to say about the Pentateuch? When was it written? What are they going to say? They're going to say it was written during the exile. Now Moses certainly wasn't during the exile, so you know Moses didn't write it that's what they're going to say. He didn't write it. It wasn't reduced to writing. These are all verbal things that have been passed down through generations. It's reduced to writing when they're in the exile, and that's the Pentateuch that we have today. That was very, very strong up to 1975, 1979 period. Now they've got some problems with that view, though. Here is what one of the scrolls said. Numbers 6, 24 through 26. Exactly the way it reads in your Bible, the way it's printed out in your modern-day Bible, but from, thousands of years ago. And that's also the first time that the oldest inscription we have of the name of Yahweh, Jehovah God. So those are things that I just think are interesting and exciting that somebody was being buried with this. They were reading the exact same script that you and I have in our Bibles. Now we come to chapter 8 in the book, Portrait of God, and we have Numbers 15 through Deuteronomy 34. You can imagine how large this section is. I don't even plan to get all the way through it because I think it really do disservice to some of the things. But we'll go through Numbers and try to finish Numbers off at least anyway. In Numbers 15, we start off here, addresses sin, sacrifice, and priesthood, and the obedience of faith. It's a kinship to Ephesians 2, 8, 9, which all of you know, for by faith have you been saved through grace, and that not of ourselves, but as the gift of God. Not of works that no man should glory, for we are his workmanship created in Christ Jesus for good works that we that God has prepared for that we should walk therein. Now, in Numbers 15, why is it significant that God is addressing these sacrifices and the way to appropriate grace, the his saving grace, the forgiveness for sins? Because they have just had this calamity of being pushed off and saying, no, you're not going to enter the promised land. You've sinned. I've lost my patience. That's one too many times. You have not had obedient faith. You're not entering in. But immediately after Numbers 14, he goes and shows them this way of appropriating grace. What does that remind you of in Genesis, say, chapter 3? Soon as the fall of man happens, soon as the dark clouds of evil could overshadow all the glory that we had with God, and you could just see it as the fall happens, and he walks in, and he's cursing man and woman and the serpent, and immediately following there is Genesis 3 and 15. Doesn't leave you 1 minute without a way of appropriating God's saving grace. And I see the same thing here. They're not to enter the promised land. No, and then Numbers 15. And then we have Numbers 15, 32 through 36. A man is stoned for picking up sticks. You know, right here, I think the Bible is trying to tell us something, the way this narrative plays out. Now, you know this could have been written anywhere, and it could have been played out in any kind of chronological order. But if you notice in Numbers 15, verse 30 and 31, he's just gone through all the sacrifices and what they have to make atonement for their souls. And then he comes up to 30 and he says, but the soul that doeth aught with a high hand, whether he be homeborn or a sojourner, the same blasphemeth Jehovah, and that soul shall be cut off from among the people because he hath despised the word of Jehovah and hath broken his commandment. That soul shall utterly be cut off. His iniquity shall be upon him. So he's saying there's a difference. In the rebellion to God, there's a difference. And immediately following that, we find out this man is picking up sticks on the Sabbath day. And they wonder what to do with him. And then, of course, verse 37, he says, you'll put him to death. Put him to death. And then verse 37, he says, he comes back again, reiterates, and says, you're going to put fringes on your garments. Now, see, doesn't that start to put it in perspective? He's telling you how to appropriate grace. But then he says, but there's going to be the rebellious soul that does these things. And then right after that, the man picking up sticks, you're going to put him to death. And he comes right back and says, I want you to hem your garments with these tassels. And what are they for? To remember the commandments of God that I've told you to do. So that is not, it's just not spurious events being stuck in there, I don't believe. Seek not after your own heart or after your own eyes, there in 15 and 39. And then we come to chapter 16, of Korah's rebellion. This is interesting. Now, who is Korah? We're going to read about him, and this is going to be referred to again and again in your Bible. So this is going to be referred to later on. It's going to be an example. When the daughters of Israel stand up and say, we're not getting an inheritance because we're from the wrong tribe, we don't have any husbands, we don't have any men, they're going to say, our father died, and they're going to say, he wasn't part of Korah's rebellion, but he died in his own sin. And then they're going to go on, and then Moses is going to make a judgment. We'll see that here later on. But Korah stands up. What kind of leader is he? Where do you think he is? Now, if we were to look, if I had really done my homework, I'd show you right now the genealogy, right? Korah is in what relation to Moses? He's cousin or cousin-like because he's not from Amram, but he's from Amram's brother, right? So as Kohath, The priesthood comes down from not only Levi, but Kohath, right? Not the others. We call it a Levitical priesthood. The Mormons call it Aaronic priesthood. Well, it is an Aaronic priesthood. It comes down through Kohath, and it comes down through Aaron, right? Not Moses, not Miriam. It comes down through Aaron. But what about those others that are right there that are coming down along that line from Kohath, but then Izhar is his father, Amram's brother? Now, does he play a role in the tabernacle? Not in, but around, doesn't he? They have a service. They have a support function. Just like any other organization, there is a support function. Your job is not to lead. Your job is to support. Your job is not to be the one in the center, but your job is to support. How do people feel about that? Some people do a great job at it, and some people do as Korah. Korah stands up, and he does what any great politician that we've heard in the last year or two, he says, you take too much upon seeing all the congregation is holy. Don't you see that? Come on, Moses. Verse 3, all the congregation are holy, every one of them. I'm a man of the people. I'm concerned with all the people. I'm concerned with all the people. Jehovah's among them. Wherefore then lift up yourselves? Why do you lift yourself up above this assembly? You think Korah's just bleeding heart for all the people? He feels bad for the people. No. He's got what the Proverbs calls the rottenness of envy in his bones, and bitterness, bitterness, bitterness. People, that will eat us up. Not being satisfied and content with the role that God has given you. And Korah needs to be read more often. Korah comes to him and says, oh, look at this. And what does he do? Just to make sure that you know it's not about me, I've got 250 other princes that I've been in to be able to influence. Can't be about me. I got 250 other people feel the way I do. We see this all the time. All the time. And he comes up, and then he finally down here, Moses tells him in verse 9, a small thing unto you that God of Israel has separated you from the congregation of Israel, right? Because he's from the priesthood. He's a Levite. He's been separated. He's been given a job around the tabernacle, but it's not in the center. He's not the leader. And then Moses gets right to it. He knows exactly. Congregation of Israel, to bring you near to himself to do the service of the tabernacle of Jehovah and to stand before the congregation to minister unto them. And that hath he brought thee near, and all thy brethren, the sons of Levi, with thee. And seek you the priesthood also. He knows exactly what's going on. He knows that there's bitterness in his heart. And then Korah is going to be separated out. And Moses is intervening like he always does. The intermediator, he's the intercessor. He's the Christ-like, right? Just like in Acts chapter 3 and verse 22. And Moses tells him, indeed, shall the God of heaven set up a prophet before you that come from your brethren, like unto me. And it shall be that every man that hearketh unto the voice of that prophet, and that if they that do not hearken unto the voice of that prophet, they shall be cut off from the people. Moses is a Christ type, isn't he? Now, we're going to keep going through this again and again, and if you don't understand types and anti-types, we're in a whole lot of trouble here with the Bible. What if Korah had been successful and Moses would have went, you know what, you're right. I think we got this thing too narrow. Because really what Korah's after is he's going to overthrow the priesthood and said, let's be a little bit more inclusive. Well, God's type that he set up was the Aaronic priesthood. And then we find out in Hebrews chapter 6 that Christ is the ultimate high priest after the order of Melchizedek. But Aaron served that purpose as the type, just like Moses served that purpose as a Christ type. So it may seem to be a small thing to him and his brethren. They may think about egalitarianism, but really what's happening is they're overthrowing what God has purposed and brought down. So it's a whole lot bigger than even Korah knows at this point, but he's going to find out when the earth opens up that it is a big deal. And it's a big deal to the other 250 that get devoured by fire, right? Everybody that's offering up that has that censer that he says. And after these things, when Korah swallowed up and all of the people surrounded him with his family, we find out later some of his sons were saved, but and then the 250, it's amazing that we come down to verse 41 of 16. On the morrow, the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron, saying, "You have killed the people of Jehovah." Can you imagine? I mean, Moses has fallen on his face so many times, and God says, "Just get away from them. I'm going to consume them in a moment. My patience is running thin." And Moses is always the one right on his face. In fact, he falls down in front of Korah because he knows the gravity of the situation, and Korah has no idea because he's justified it to himself. He's not getting his just due. He's a man of the people, and he's standing there, and Moses has got his face in the dirt. And later on, Moses even says, "So that you'll know, I didn't take this upon myself." In fact, we know that Moses kept trying to throw it off, didn't he? There was a time when he could have took it on himself, when he was 40 years old and he could grab a man by the neck and put him in the ground. There was a time when Moses could have said, "Yeah, you know what, let's go." But that's not the Moses God used. God used him after he threw him out in this Midian desert, and he's wandering around for 40 more years, and he's aging, and he's a sheep herder. And then he goes back on a donkey. That's the Moses God is using, and that's the Moses that falls down with his face in the dirt. That's incredible. That's incredible. I see maybe the slightest hint right here the first time that I see Moses begin to get mad. It says Moses got wroth with him. He started to get angry. And he tells God about these other individuals that are not coming out from the camp because they said, "Well, what are you going to do? You're going to pluck our eyes out too? We could see that you have put yourself up above the congregation. You've taken all these things on your shoulders. We could see that. You're going to pluck our eyes out too? We could see it." And then Moses finally gets a little bit towards the end. And he tells Jehovah God, he says, Don't have any mercy on what they're offering up. That's the first time we find out Moses talking to God like that. It's just a hint of he's towards the end of his rope. He's already had a breakdown before, and God's done everything he can to bring him to this point. And then we find out maybe that has something to do with the succeeding chapters that we're about to get into. But the people stand there and say, "You have killed the people of Jehovah." Hard for them to see, I imagine. And a plague goes out, and of course Aaron goes out and stays the plague, but still there's 14,700 that die because of that. Amazing. We get into Numbers chapter 17, and God then again, okay, his mercy, his grace is going to do what? What does grace do? It teaches, right? Grace teaches. Grace teaches you the appropriation, how to appropriate his saving grace, how to appropriate his mercy, what it requires to stay, you know, in good stead with God. Remember, it's not about accepting him. The whole biblical narrative is about how he accepts you, whether or not he accepts what you have to offer. And then he goes right back, 17, and he says, "All right, I'm going to show you once again who I have chosen as the priest and therefore the priesthood. And it's Aaron and it's his rod." And they take all those rods and the princes of each tribe and they put them out. And which one buds, has the buds, the almonds on it that are ripe. And then, they put that before the testimony for remembrance from that period on. And that's what God's doing. Again, reaffirming. And then, of course, in verse 12, you can see up there on the screen is kind of amazing here too. They just seem to, you know, I guess out of their rebellious spirit, it's just hard for them to say, "You know what, if we just succumb to what God's saying, we're going to be okay." They don't seem to get that. They don't seem to get to that point. We're going to see one of these individuals later on kind of like that, where God's telling them things, but he's just not satisfied with it. And that's where they are. They're just never satisfied with it. And so now they're like, "Well, you know what? We just don't know what to do. Every time we turn around, somebody's dying here." Well, that's true. But every time you turn around, you guys are rebelling against God. He's done everything for you. And His grace is teaching you every day what He wants, what He demands. Again, the community church movement is what? It's about saying everybody's going to meet God wherever they are. And I always ask my friends when we're in these discussions to say, where is that in the Bible anywhere? It's always been the other way around. It's not about where God wants to meet God or people want to meet God. It's the other way around. It's where He demands to be met. And so He lets them know. Now, chapter 18. So their efforts are futile. They're saying, look, we're just undone. We don't know what to do. Every time we turn around, we're getting killed. So then he goes into Numbers 18. Now, this is why I think it's good to go through chronologically these events. If we just pulled this out and I told you to read this, you'd go, that's just crazy. It's just hard to understand. Why in the world does he spend a whole chapter on how to burn a heifer and where to burn it and that you're unclean after you burn it? And that you need to use this running water over here, and you're going to sprinkle somebody on the third day, and you're going to sprinkle them on the seventh day, and then they're going to be... You know, I guess the only thing I can think of is I tried to think up an example for this. If I told you I was going to give one of my daughters a piece of candy for something that I asked her to do for me. Now, I haven't told you what I asked her to do for me, but I told you her reward is a piece of candy. What do you think in your mind that conjures up? Is it a big deal, what I'm asking her to do? Not at all. Not at all. No big deal at all. What if I told you that my life savings was $20,000 and I promised it to any of my daughters that were going to do something? You don't even have to know what that is, but you know that's going to be some kind of lifetime achievement. That's something very huge. It's monumental. I think this is the same principle, but in reverse order. God cannot stress more about this sin and how it defiles people and how it separates us from Him. So He goes through all these details to try to say, this is a big deal. You don't do this in one day. This isn't something you could just go, hey, we got 5 minutes on Saturday, let's burn the heifer and let's get this over with. You can't do that. And He wants to make sure you know that part of your life is going to be wrapped up and built around the fact that you need the right heifer, unblemished, at the right age, and it's going to be burnt, and all these things need to be put into it. And when that happens, that person is unclean, and that person goes and washes with water, and the clothes are cleaned. And these things have to happen, not with stagnant water. The faithless individual that says, hey, it's just good enough. They're going to argue for what? The black heifer or the black bull. Close enough. Water for communion rather than fruit of the vine. Just close enough. We might as well take it on Saturday. I know we don't read about that, but it's pretty convenient. And so that's what the heart of unbelief is. And it's interesting, just like Moses, what we're going to find out, when you don't obey God, it doesn't matter whether you're in a conversation with Him or not. What does He call it? He calls it unbelief. Belief in the Bible has nothing to do with what modern-day religionists think belief is. God's not talking about some mental, picture in your mind saying, yeah, I believe there's a God. That's not belief. He could be in a conversation with you, and if you rebel, He says it's unbelief. And we're going to find that out. And this right here, I believe, is takes up a whole chapter for a reason. He's trying to impress upon them what the defiling nature of sin is. And because of His grace. Numbers 18, grace. Grace teaches. For the grace of God hath appeared, bringing salvation to all men, instructing us to the intent that denying ungodliness and worldly lust, we should live soberly, righteously, and godly in this present world. Numbers 20, I'm going to get in a little bit of a reverse order here. This is a big chapter in the Bible. These are some big events here. Miriam dies in Numbers 20. There's barely a passage given to her. I think it's somewhat of a sad fact, though. She was a leader of her people. She was a prophetess. She played a big role in Moses, in his life, in the people of Israel. But she is not going to enter into the promised land. She dies, and she leaves four individuals, basically about this point, that are over 59 years old. This is towards the end. So we're already 40 years through the wilderness wanderings as we get up here after some of these battles in the next year or two. And as she dies off, there's going to be very few left. Miriam's death, Israel is murmuring. They are murmuring about water at Meribah, and then Moses and Aaron's sin at Meribah with the water, and then Edom's hatred. Now, I want to get, let's skip Moses and Aaron's sin. Let's come back to that because it's a big one. But let me just show you a map. I don't know how this is going to show up. Probably not good at all. But you see the red there that goes up and splits off into two, and then there's kind of a candy cane stripe on it. I don't know if you could see that. The purple is one of the trading highways. That's probably where Joseph was sold and goes down into Egypt. But if you look at the red, that's called the King's Highway. The remnant's still there today, because roads are built on top of trails where they've used them for years. That's the King's Highway, and that's where you see it's to the right. You probably can't see that. But in your Bible, if you had a map, you could see that that King's Highway runs up from Mount Seir through the high country, and it goes through Edom, and then it's going to go through Moab, and then it's going to go through the land of the Amorites. And when it does that, Israel is really requesting that they go on the King's Highway, go through Edom. All right? It's over to the right side of the Dead Sea. It's south of the Dead Sea, or the Salt Sea, is the land of Edom. Okay, and there's a little bit closer picture. That dotted line on the right is the King's Highway. Where it says Araba right there, that is Edom. All right, and who is Edom? Comes from Esau. How does Edom end up there? When Jacob runs off and goes and finds two wives and comes back with a mass, where is Esau at that point? So he's in the land of Canaan. He's on the other side over towards Hebron and those other areas. He is in the land of Canaan. That's where he's meeting Jacob. But just very shortly thereafter that, he realizes that Jacob is too large along with his own kin. So he leaves and says, I'm going to have to remove myself. And he removes himself and he goes off to Mount Seir, which is south of the Salt Sea. We don't read anything else about that until this point right here. Now Moses comes up and he says, we want to cross over. We're going to buy the water. We're not going to touch any of your land. We're not going to do anything. We're not going to kill any cattle. We're not going to look to the right or left. We just want to go down the King's Highway. And Edom says, no way. Now, can Israel take Edom at this point? Why doesn't God say, hey, let's just take them? Because what he's going to do later is the people just north of that, when they say the same thing, what's he going to do? He's absolutely going to smash them. So why doesn't he smash Edom? Because the land they're sitting on, this is the rest of the story. And I love the way the Bible does this. You could read through these narratives right up to a point and you say, well, I think I understand everything about it. Then you find out something later in the New Testament, right? Like Acts chapter 7 is a great example of a narrative that throws in details that you don't know. Well, in this case right here, you won't find out until you get to Deuteronomy 2, chapter 2, verse 5. Why are they sitting on Mount Seir? Because Jehovah God gave that to Esau. That's what he says. I gave them this land. Just like I gave Abraham and promised his seed, the land of Canaan, that promised land, he gave this to Jacob's brother. So he's sitting on the land that God gave him, and God's not going to allow him to touch him, even though they're being a little bit unneighborly, and that's what happens. So they say, no, you're not going to pass through here. Let's talk about Moses and Aaron's sin here. In verse 10, well, let's go back up further. Let's go up to verse 7. Jehovah spoke to Moses after these people are murmuring. He says, take the rod and assemble the congregation, thou and Aaron, thy brother. Speak you unto the rock before their eyes, that it give forth water. So Moses says to speak, and you shall bring forth them water out of the rock. So you shall give the congregation and their cattle to drink. Jehovah God told Moses, you're going to do this. You're going to do it. Moses goes down there, and then Moses and Aaron gathered to the assembly in verse 10 before the rock, and he said unto them, hear now, ye rebels, shall we bring forth water out of the rock? Moses lifted up his hand, smote the rock twice. Water came forth abundantly, and the congregation drank and the cattle. Jehovah said unto Moses and Aaron, because ye believe not in me, to sanctify me in the eyes of the children of Israel. And we've talked about this before, right? There's no way that people could argue with some modern-day conception of belief that Moses did not believe in Jehovah God. Oh, he believed. He didn't talk to him in dark sayings. He didn't talk to him in visions. He talked to him face to face. meekest man in all the earth. He had that relationship that no one else would ever have until Jesus Christ comes along. He's talking to Moses face to face. Moses believed, but what happens here? In fact, he tells him, you're going to bring forth water out of this rock. You're going to do this. And Moses goes over there and says, are we going to bring forth water out of this rock for you? And this is where the rest of the story comes in. In Psalms 106, we see just a huge listing of facts and narratives about what's happened here. And the Hebrew says that he babbled unadvisedly with his lips. Moses babbled unadvisedly with his lips. I think it's much more than striking a rock when he was supposed to speak to it. He did not sanctify God. That has very little to do with whether you hit a rock with a rod or speak to it. But he didn't sanctify God, and I think the key is when he said, shall we bring forth water out of this rock? Even though God said, you're going to do it, he knew where that power was coming from. He knew who was supposed to be providing, and Moses himself was what? He was the mediator. He was the intercessor. He was the one that was the go-between. You all have seen this in your work, haven't you? There's a point where the person you're working for, your boss, takes it upon themselves to act like it's their idea. You can sniff a bad leader out a lot of times because somewhere in there it begins to be we and me and my, and I'm going to do this, when you know very well it's coming from somebody else. Moses is the greatest mediator, and yet God's trying to show us even Moses could not do it. And we need a perfect mediator. Moses, the most humblest man in the world, is not going to be able to do it. And of course, Aaron is there with him. And Aaron's had some mars on his record. Verse 24, it says, because you rebelled against my word at the waters of Meribah. Rebellious heart, babbling unadvisedly with the lips, failure to sanctify me in their eyes. And he sums it up by saying, you believe not in me. If you don't obey God's word, hereby we know that we know him if we keep his commandments, right? 1 John 2 and 3. Period. Hereby we know that we know him if we keep his commandments. If you don't keep his commandments, you can claim anything you want. But you're not where you need to be. Numbers 20, Eleazar's priesthood, Aaron's death. This is the 40th year. They're down to Aaron and Moses, and then Joshua and Caleb, aren't they? So there's four individuals that are fairly old at this point, and everybody else is about 60 years old and younger. Everyone, out of the 2 million people. Now, this is a sad event. They go to Hor, and Aaron here is going to go up in front of the people. Now, I know he's had some mars on his record. I know he hasn't been perfect. I know he hasn't been the one that we hold out as, oh, Aaron was such a great guy. Listen, you know, it's one of those guys that you've just been in the trenches with your whole life. Maybe you didn't in the beginning appreciate each other. You didn't get along. But, you know, after a while, you've been in the trenches with them, and there's just some kind of connection and camaraderie there. Aaron has been there from the beginning of the coming out through the Red Sea and how he's put up with all these things. Some of it he's partaken of. Some of it he hasn't stood up to. Some of it he hasn't done as well. But he's just been there through thick and thin, through all the wanderings. And now he's a point, he's an old man. And he's going to put on his priestly garments that have been so, evoke some envy and jealousy. And he's going to walk up in front of these people, and only Moses and Eleazar go up, and he's going to go up there with him, and he's not going to come down. I think there's something dignified and stately about that as Moses takes Aaron up, Aaron not to return. Eleazar would come back down and would be appointed the high priest. And Aaron died there on the top of the mountain. And then we get to Numbers 21, the military victory over the Canaanites. They come down and they actually start nipping at the heels of this body. If you can imagine, if you have 2 million people camped out and you're wandering around, I could tell you right now, somebody's going to be vulnerable. All right? It's not going to be the people in the middle. May not be people in the north if you got enemies in the south. But somebody's going to be vulnerable, and they start picking off the weak ones here. And then they go back, and they say, all right, we've had enough of that. And he allows them just to smash the Canaanites. And then they begin to murmur again. And they said, well, our soul loatheth this light bread. Okay, God, you've provided for us. We couldn't provide for ourselves. How do you feed millions of people in a desert? Well, we can't do it, but God does it for us. But you know what? That's just not good enough. I don't really like what you've given us. I mean, I read about a mighty kingdom, and you give me the church? You got to be kidding me. I hear that all the time. This is some spiritual intercession, you know, intermeasure or something, that because it just didn't all culminate the way it was supposed to culminate. That's somebody that just takes and says, my soul loatheth this light bread. I'm not satisfied. And so he sends out the fiery serpents. And then they know. They're starting to be educated now, because they said, we have sinned. And they go to Moses and they say, we have sinned before Jehovah our God. Pray for us that he remove these serpents. And all of that is great. And Moses goes and makes intercession to God, and he prays. And then what's God do with the serpents? Not a thing. He didn't take them out of the way, people. He doesn't take the serpents away. He gives them a remedy for the serpent. Put a serpent on a staff. Make a brazen serpent and put it in the center. And when you get bit before you die, make it to the serpent and look upon the serpent and you'll live. I think that is really poignant. I think that's, and so John comes along later and he says, that's right. He's writing down the words of Jesus, and he said, just like the serpent was lifted up in the wilderness, so shall the Son of Man be lifted up, that whoever believes on him shall have eternal life. It's the remedy. It's not the consequence of sin is not going to disappear from this earth. You can't fix it with a political election. You can't fix it with an activist movement, because the problem is sin. And there's only a remedy for sin through Jesus Christ. And I know Christians that are bitter because the consequences of sin. And I say, you know what? They're not going away. God is not mocked. Whatsoever man soweth, that shall he also reap. But he does with every temptation make a way of escape, that you may be able to endure it. That's different. That's not taking out every stumbling block. Now, he may remove some barriers. He may strengthen you. There may be things that he does through his providential care, but I think it is really, really a sharp illustration that they're praying for the serpent to disappear, to take it away. That doesn't happen. He just gives them a remedy. And they need to look on that serpent. And like every great thing that God does, every great thing, what does man do with it? After a while, man just has disconnected it from the reason that God gave it to him. What happened 700 years later during a restoration and a revival in Israel, and Hezekiah begins to tear down the high places, and he's going about doing God's will, and he comes upon a what? A brazen serpent that they had been burning incense to. Because the people of God seldom discipline yourself to do the things the way God told you to do them, for the right reason that God told you to do it, and not go beyond. Because the simple things that seem simple today may be simple next week and the month after that, but 700 years later, what happens? I mean, you go back and you read about the history of the Catholic Church. You think it started where it is now? No, it didn't start there, but they got there. Just like they're burning incense to the serpent here. God gave it to them for a reason, but they couldn't keep that in mind. And so they go and do what man always does. And then they go and have a military victory over the Amorites. Now, if you were to study this a little bit, even in secular history, you're going to see these accounts start to line up, because what happens to Moab is the Moabites get conquered and Sion comes down from the Amorites and takes the land of Moab and kicks them further out to that dirt and dust and desert into the east. So first they're going to go up against Sihon, and they're going to take him, and they're going to go against Og of Bashan. They're going to take him, which is further to the north. And then who are they going to have to deal with? The people that are out in the desert to the east that go, wait a minute, those guys that took us over, that kicked us out, they just got smashed. And so they're going to send off for Balaam, who is what? Is he a prophet of God or is he a soothsayer? And you can't be both. This is a very, very interesting period right here. And if we had time, and we will next week, we'll go through the differences. And believe me, here's a hint. If God could put his words into a donkey, he doesn't need a man of God to speak for him. He could put his word in anybody's mouth. All right, thank you so much.